Welcome to Human Rights 2020s, brought to you by the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. In this episode, Andy Cyril, Legal Director and Partner at Just Rights Scotland, discusses the Illegal Migration Act, a human rights emergency.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this webinar that's all about the Illegal Migration Act. Thank you for joining us and taking this time. I am sure that many of you have been aware of this act as it was going through Westminster, as it was a bill and all the discussions around it. So the purpose of this afternoon is to really look at, well, what is in the act, what are some of the impacts of that, and actually what can be done about that. Where things are at. As you know, the Illegal Migration Act is an assault on human rights. It is a really serious regression on human rights protections. It suggests that human rights protections are for only some of us and not all of us. And that's not obviously the case. It is also a dehumanising piece of legislation. And so we really want to understand it well, to know what the impacts are and do all we can to mitigate some of the worst of that if we can. So a huge thank you to Just Rights Scotland and specifically to Andy Cyril and to Sabrina Galello, who's been helping with this webinar. And Andy's going to speak today and really share his expertise, which is hugely welcome because it is quite complicated. So Andy, over to you.
Thanks very much, Vari, and hello, everybody. Thank you very much for having me along. So my name is Andy Cyril. I'm a partner and legal director at Just Rights Scotland, and I have responsibility for our anti-trafficking and refugee work at Just Rights Scotland. The idea behind this presentation and this webinar is to give basically an update on where we are, what's changed, what changed between the Bill and the Act, some of its impacts in Scotland, and some of the sort of next steps that we foresee coming to pass, what we can do about it, really. I'm assuming a varied level of knowledge within the audience, okay? So I'm going to assume, I'm actually going to assume no knowledge going in and get everybody on the same sort of platform before we get started. So in terms of a recap, okay, I always like to start with a basic recap about international protection, what it is, some of the key facts, you know, what is the issue here? So asylum law in the UK is governed by the UN Refugee Convention. The core principle behind it is called non-refoulement, and that means that a person cannot be returned to a country where they face serious threats to their life or their freedom. The UN Refugee Convention was established after World War II. Every person has the right to seek asylum from persecution. Okay, every person has the right to seek asylum from persecution. Not every person has the right to get it. You know, it's a determination process, but everybody has the right to ask. Very important point. 149 countries have signed the convention. States, including the UK, have an asylum system which determines if a person needs international protection. And if they go through this system, they will get what we call refugee status. Third thing to bear in mind, in order to claim asylum in the UK, you must be inside the UK. Okay? You cannot claim asylum from abroad. There is no visa to apply for, to come in and obtain asylum. And as a result of that, there is actually no legal way to enter the UK in order to claim asylum. There used to be a way to come into the UK legally and then claim asylum. It was called the Dublin Regulation. It was a European Union instrument. And when we left the European Union, that closed. So we have a situation where you need to be in the UK to claim asylum, but there's no legal way to get into the UK to claim asylum. And that actually is the big sort of elephant in the room with this piece of legislation. We do have what we call resettlement schemes. Some resettlement schemes, I should say. These are schemes where people come to the UK for protection, but they don't go through the asylum process. They already come pre-screened into the United Kingdom with some form of protection status. These schemes are very, very limited. Most of them have closed down in the last sort of 10 years. We now really, broadly speaking, only have three ones that function: the Ukraine scheme, the Hong Kong screen, and to an extent, there's a scheme for Afghans, although it's taken very, very few people. So these are not the same as the asylum process. When someone claims asylum in the UK, they receive what we call asylum support until they obtain status or are refused. If they live in community-based accommodation, they get £45 a week, so around about £6 or so a day to live on. If they are in hotel accommodation and that hotel provides meals, they get £9.10 a week, so a shade over £1.50 odd per day to live on. Asylum seekers cannot access work, they cannot access benefits, they cannot access social housing, they cannot access a whole host of fairly basic rights. Victims of trafficking get special support in recognition of their vulnerability and the risks of re-trafficking and their experiences for a period of time. And unaccompanied children are generally looked after by social work services, by our local authorities. Okay, so these are the basic facts that we're operating in the here and now. Okay, the UK asylum process at this moment in time, based on stats from last year, is operated by the Home Office, and it grants 80% of people some form of leave to remain, according to stats from last year. And the 20% that they don't grant, about half of those decisions are overturned by the Immigration Tribunal. So what does the Illegal Migration Act say, and what has changed? There are basically seven different elements to it. And I'm going to go through each of them in turn. Removal, protection claims, leave to remain in British citizenship, destinations, so removal destinations, detention, children, trafficking, and something called age assessment. A disclaimer at the very beginning, because this is really important for this webinar. There is a difference, okay, between an act passing and obtaining what we call royal assent and an act coming into force. It's very easy to assume that when an act obtains royal assent, that's it in force. It's being implemented in our everyday. But actually, that's quite rare. Usually, when a piece of legislation goes through Parliament and it's passed and it obtains royal assent, there's a period of time that we wait before it gets actually implemented. Some acts get royal assent and are never actually implemented. So the Illegal Migration Act 2023 obtained royal assent, got stamped as a piece of legislation passed by the British Parliament on the 20th of July 2023. However, only some of its provisions are in force, and in fact, the majority are not. So although it's a piece of legislation, most of it is not yet in force. And there's a very simple reason for that. And the reason is because a lot of its applicability hinges on whether the so-called Rwanda plan can come into force. The Rwanda plan being the UK government's deal with the Rwandan government to remove people who come into the UK to seek asylum to Rwanda in order to have their claims processed there by the Rwandan government and for them to live over in Rwanda. This was challenged in the courts. It was found to be unlawful by the Court of Appeal, and it was heard, the lawfulness of the Rwanda plan was heard the 9th, 10th and 11th of this month, and we are expecting a judgment in November or December. So everything actually relating to this act, or the most important bits, hinge on Rwanda, and I'll explain why now. So the cornerstone of this piece of legislation is what we call Section 2. This is not in force yet, but this is really the main part of the act. The Act imposes a duty on the Home Office to remove anybody who meets these four criteria. Okay, did you enter the United Kingdom without leave to remain, or did you obtain leave to remain through deception? Did you enter after the 20th of July? Did you travel through a safe country to get to the United Kingdom? And do you have leave to remain right now that you're here? Okay, these four criteria are really, really important. The difference between the bill and the act is the date that was put in place here. During the course of the bill, the date was the 7th of March. Did you enter after the 7th of March? But when it became an act, they moved the date up to the 20th of July. Now, like I said, this is not yet in force. but it is the key premise of the bill. If you meet these four criteria, then the Home Office must remove you. And that's very serious, because actually the vast majority of asylum seekers will meet this criteria, those who enter the United Kingdom after the 20th of July. And the reason that is because, as I said before, it's not possible to enter the United Kingdom to seek asylum legally. Entering through a safe country, we are an island in the North Atlantic. Most people need to pass through a safe third country to enter the United Kingdom. So it's a very, very restrictive element of the Act. If you are an unaccompanied child and you come into the United Kingdom and you meet these criteria, the duty to remove you does not apply until you turn 18 years old. You can still be removed if you're under 18, but the duty to remove you does not apply until you're 18 years old. Now, the question you might ask, well, what happens if somebody claims asylum? You know, you've been telling us about non-refoulement and the Refugee Convention and that kind of thing. The duty to remove you, or the duty to remove a person, applies regardless of whether a person claims asylum, makes a human rights claim, is a victim of trafficking, or lodges a court action called a judicial review against removal. It applies without exception. What's more, the Act places a duty on the Home Office to ignore asylum claims and protection claims. So anybody who's entered the United Kingdom after the 20th of July without leave to remain through a third country and they claim asylum, the Home Office cannot consider it. They just have to ignore it. And that does not have any exceptions. That also applies to children. What this means, in actual fact, is that Section 5 and Section 2 actually abolish the asylum system for almost everybody who uses it. If you come into the country after that period of time, you're not allowed to claim asylum and you have to be removed. That is a massive, massive change to what we have right now. It's difficult to overstate just how serious that is. The question then you'll have, I'm sure, is, well, removal to where? And the answer to that question depends on where you come from. Again, these provisions here are not in force yet, but everything depends on Rwanda for reasons that are about to become clear. The Act creates, if you come from Albania, and this is a deliberate example because people who come from Albania have been a target for the government in the course of this legislation. If you come from Albania, then you have a certain criteria that you need to meet. The Act creates a list of safe countries. This is effectively European countries plus Albania. And if you come from one of the countries on this list, the default is that that is a safe country and you can immediately go back there. So if an Albanian person claims asylum, the Home Office will say the default position is you can go straight back to Albania. And the only consideration they have in challenging that is if there are exceptional circumstances preventing removal to Albania. You will not be admitted to the asylum process in that circumstance. They will just decide if there are exceptional circumstances. Even if it is agreed that there are exceptional circumstances, the Home Office's default position is to then seek to remove to a third country. Now, this is an extremely serious situation for Albanians because going by the Home Office's own statistics, the grant rate of asylum to Albanian women is 85% and for children was 87% based on last year's statistics. If you do not come from Albania, if a person comes from anywhere else in the world, Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, Iran, then the situation is this. If you come into the country after the 20th of July, you claim asylum, the Home Office accept that you cannot be returned to your home country. And that's because they want to stick by this idea of non-refoulement. But if you think about it, they're not going to consider your claim for asylum. So instead, what they do is pledge to return a person to a third country. In order to return a person to a third country, that third country needs to agree to it. There is only one country in the world that the UK government has struck an agreement to return people to, and that's Rwanda. As I said, the Rwandan plan is stuck in the courts, and the Supreme Court are hearing and are deciding right now about whether it's even lawful. This is why most of the Illegal Migration Act is not yet in force, because it hinges on telling every asylum seeker who enters the country after the 20th of July that they must be removed to the UK and they must go to Rwanda. But if they can't, but if the courts so far have stopped people going to Rwanda. So everything waits on the Supreme Court case. If the UK Supreme Court says that Rwanda is legal, then I would expect this act to start to come into force. If they say it is not legal, then I would expect them to say that the act cannot come into force. Here's some things that have come into force, though. The Act has provisions about leave to remain in British citizenship. The Act says if you came into the United Kingdom after the 20th of July illegally, then you should never be able to get a visa to stay here. You should never be able to get leave to remain. You should never be able to get indefinite leave to remain. And you should never be able to get British citizenship. And they only and they say that is the case unless there are limited exceptions that apply. Those limited exceptions would be if to refuse to give you any leave to remain would be a violation of the European Convention on Human Rights or other international agreements. Now, the Refugee Convention is another international agreement, but we don't know yet how this is going to be applied. What's really important that you understand, though, is that this part of the Act is already in force, okay? And it applies retrospectively. So it's not about whether you came in before the 20th of July, it's about whether you came after the 20th of July, sorry, it's about whether you came in after the 7th of March. And that's really important to understand. This applies to people who came into the United Kingdom illegally after the 7th of March. That means there are people who arrived and they're in the asylum process right now where the law says you cannot get leave to remain unless exceptional circumstances apply. We don't know whether, therefore, whether people are going to be granted refugee status or not. And it seems clear that they're not going to be granted settlement or a route to citizenship either if this act remains in place. So people who are in that situation need to speak to their solicitors immediately to understand this more clearly. So this is a summary of the timeline of the act just now. Okay, if you arrived in the United Kingdom before the 7th of March, you can claim asylum, you can get refugee status. Everything applies as it was then. If you arrived after the 7th of March, you can claim asylum, but you've got a bar to obtaining leave to remain. You can only get leave to remain if it's a violation of your human rights, basically. And it would appear that you're not able to get settlement or British citizenship. And then for those who enter after the 20th of July, 2023, if those provisions come into force, then it's much more bleak. Unable to claim asylum and enforced removal from the UK. But remember, that's only if the Supreme Court give the green light to the Rwanda plan. Now, if you are issued with a removal notice, if we're issued with a removal notice telling us that we need to go to Rwanda, what happens then? Well, this is a really challenging area. A person only has 8 days to challenge such a removal notice. And there are two things that they need to do. They need to make a human rights claim to the Home Office, and write to the Home Office and say, removing me to Rwanda would be a violation of my human rights because ... But they also need to make something called a suspensive claim to the Home Office. This is like the emergency brake. And the reason why a person needs to make a suspensive claim is because simply saying to the Home Office, this is a violation of my human rights, is not enough to keep them in the country. The Home Office will seek to remove, and then you can have your appeal against that happen after a person's been removed. So the suspensive claim is the emergency brake, and it allows a person to remain in the country to have their case heard. The kicker is that for both these things, you need a lawyer. And for both these things, you need to provide compelling evidence. We're not sure what that means yet. But the difficulty is obtaining a lawyer, obtaining the compelling evidence, and lodging both of these claims to the Home Office within a period of 8 days. That is extraordinarily difficult if you're in a hotel in Aberdeen sharing a room with somebody, or in Falkirk or in Bathgate or wherever you happen to be. It's a huge difficulty to do that, and it's a big access to justice gap that we have here in Scotland. I'll come back on that point shortly. The refusal of a human rights claim by the Home Office is only challengeable by judicial review, and the refusal of a suspensive claim is only challengeable in the upper tribunal. This means, again, lawyers, time, money. It's going to become a very, very expensive process. To my knowledge, in Edinburgh, there are approximately 2 law firms that do immigration legal aid. And to my knowledge, outside of Glasgow and Edinburgh, there are none. So when you have hotels spread across the country, Falkirk, Aberdeen, all sorts of other places, Elgin, there are simply no lawyers in those localities. So how is a person supposed to be challenging these decisions? The short answer, sadly, is that unless urgent action takes place, many won't be able to. The next part of the Act talks about detention, and this is also now partially in force. The Act provides for detention for such a period as in the opinion of the Secretary of State, so the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, is reasonably necessary to enable the examination and removal to be carried out. What this means is that unlike just now, or unlike previously, when detention was only supposed to happen in order to effect immediate removal, and it had a lot of scrutiny, objective scrutiny from the courts, detention is now purely on the whim of the Home Secretary. It's now a matter of her opinion rather than any objective criteria. This came into force on the 28th of September. So it's already in force. And what this is going to lead to happen, and I think we're already seeing it, is that detention is going to become more frequent, and it's going to last longer than it ever did before. The other couple of bits relating to detention that are not yet in force are the delay in your ability to apply for bail in order to be released from detention. If this part of the Act comes into force, that will be extended to 28 days. So that's basically a mandatory month in detention without any ability to apply for release. And in what I think is one of the more extraordinary parts of this rather extraordinary Act, detention cannot be challenged by way of judicial review, apart from in the most extreme circumstance. What this provision does, Section 12, is it gives the Home Secretary, the executive, the power to detain people arbitrarily for an indefinite period of time. And it says in black and white in the legislation that the courts are not allowed to review it. In my opinion, that looks and feels very authoritarian. The provisions as they relate to unaccompanied asylum-seeking children, these are not yet in force. They give the Home Office the power to care and support for unaccompanied children in England for an unspecified period of time. What we've seen so far is that this looks like hotels and it may well result in reception centres or detention facilities. I think some of you may remember the Immigration Minister Robert Jendrick giving an order that the cartoon murals that were on the walls of one of these reception centres needed to be painted over because it was too welcoming. These types of reception centres, Marston, etc., are I think likely if these provisions come into force. The Home Office also gives itself the power to direct local authorities when they start looking after children in need in their area and when they need to terminate the care and transfer them back to the Home Office. The Home Office can, in fact, force local authorities to comply with their orders by threatening contempt of court and unlimited fines. And this can be extended to Scotland and Wales through regulations. This is a moment where the Home Office is telling Scottish local authorities and local authorities in England, of course, that your children's legislation, your child protection framework is trumped by what we say about immigration. It creates a twin-track child protection process that's determined by your nationality or your migration status. In my view, it's quite clearly discriminatory, but it creates all sorts of other problems for local authorities and how they protect children in their area who are located in Home Office accommodation or under the care of the Home Office. The provisions around human trafficking, these are not yet in force either. Survivors of trafficking who have received an initial decision from the Home Office confirming that they may be a victim of trafficking are not protected from removal. So this Act, to be very clear, removes victims of trafficking, even where the Home Office say, we accept you're a victim of trafficking. There is only a very limited exception to this, this rule. Trafficking survivors will only be granted leave to remain and not removed where they are cooperating with a criminal investigation or a public body investigation, and the Home Office think that they absolutely need to be here to cooperate with that investigation. Now, as a person who works in anti-trafficking on a daily basis, representing victims of trafficking, I can probably count the number of prosecutions into trafficking in Scotland on one hand in the last 10 years or so. They are extremely rare. It's an extremely difficult crime to prosecute. But what makes it even harder is that the Act strips victims of trafficking of support and assistance from the specialist agencies that exist already. So organisations like TARA and Migrant Help, who provide safe house accommodation, one-to-one advocacy, connecting them in with healthcare, education, and additional stipend, rest and recovery, that will be stripped from victims of trafficking if they meet the criteria in Clause 2. This is an extremely serious point here. We have these protections in place for a reason. In fact, to fail to do so is a violation of Article 4 of the European Convention. This is a positive obligation that the state has to say, you're a victim of trafficking, it's our job to try and protect you. And this Act is compelling Scottish Government, essentially, to not do that. I suppose that the secondary point to that, and it's a really important one, is if your goal is to prosecute traffickers and stop trafficking, which I think is at least the purported goal of the UK government, punishing the victims is very, very unlikely to get you there. In fact, in our experience around prosecutions of trafficking in Scotland, where our clients have been key witnesses in those prosecutions, it's because of the support and assistance they've received. But if you strip them of that support and assistance, they will not be able to cooperate with the investigation, and therefore the prosecution will not go ahead. So these provisions, in fact, will reduce prosecutions of trafficking, in our opinion. I'm going to finish this the cheery overview of the Act by touching very briefly on age assessment. Okay, the Act slipped in at the very end before it went through a couple of additional provisions around age assessment. Age assessment is where the age of an unaccompanied minor who enters the country is disputed by the Home Office or a local authority or in some official capacity. Section 57 of the Act states that if you have had your age disputed and you're challenging it in the court process, that doesn't prevent you from being removed to Rwanda. What's more, Section 58 introduces what we call, or elaborates further on what we call scientific techniques for age assessment. That is x-raying or conducting an MRI on young people who we dispute their age. The Act says, if you do not consent to this medical procedure, then we will treat you as over the age of 18 and you'll be subject for removal to Rwanda. The legislation to introduce these X-ray and MRI techniques has been drafted, and it's going to be voted on in the House of Commons and the House of Lords soon. This means that although these sections are not yet in force, scientific age assessments are coming, I think probably imminently, and they are coming to Scotland through the Home Office. And this is something we need to be very aware of. So in terms of what next, I think I've made it clear that not much of the Act is in force yet, but some really important parts are. The key provisions, the duty to ignore asylum claims, the duty to remove, will only come into force if the Supreme Court approves the Rwanda scheme. We're completely speculating about timescales, but if the Supreme Court approves Rwanda in November or December, I would probably expect to see this Act come into force in January, February, March next year. Of course, if the Supreme Court says no to Rwanda, then it's difficult to know how much of this, how any of this really is going to come into force. Even if Rwanda does go ahead, there are huge questions about whether it can possibly work in practice. Last year, approximately 74,000 people claimed asylum in the UK. I don't think anyone's suggesting that that number of people can be removed to Rwanda. It simply isn't, I think, is physically impossible. But the cost around this as well is extraordinarily high. There is a chance that, of course, if there's a general election and a change of government, then much of this will not come to pass. The Labour Party's position has been to not implement Rwanda and to introduce its own immigration piece of legislation that reinstates the asylum process and reverts things back to the way that they were before. That is their on-record position. The Scottish Government has been encouraged many times to produce an action plan. We were advised that it was going to be with us in early July. We're now, unfortunately, in mid-October and we still don't have it. So we have made specific recommendations alongside partners in the sector, Scottish Refugee Council, amongst others, of what the Scottish Government needs to do to try and mitigate the impacts of the Illegal Migration Act in Scotland. That's, you know, introducing measures that combat the use of detention facilities and institutional accommodation in Scotland. How we're able to react to what this act does, which will be inevitably push people towards destitution and trafficking and exploitation. So things like the ending destitution strategy, amongst others in Scotland. How the police and the fiscal service are going to react to even less of a probability of being able to investigate and prosecute trafficking. The difficulties that local authorities are going to face with unaccompanied minors potentially going missing. If you're an unaccompanied minor and this act is in force, you know that you will not be removed until you're 18. So in the run-up to your 18th birthday, I think there's a strong likelihood, foreseeability, that you'll go missing, that you'll run away. We spoke already about the access to justice gap, individuals being kept in shared hotel rooms across Scotland in outside of urban areas where there's legal advice deserts. How are people going to challenge these removal notices? I think significant thought can be given by the Scottish Government into improving access to justice there. And of course, there are various another serious human rights violations. But there is good news and there is some positivity on the horizon. Okay, a wonderful organisation called ECPAT UK brought a court case against Kent County Council this year about the use of hotels as a matter of routine in accommodating unaccompanied children. And the court said that's illegal. They said you cannot routinely accommodate unaccompanied minors in hotels. That is obviously a part of what the Home Office were anticipating doing with the provisions on children in this Act. And this case says, well, you can't do that. That's a positive win. We've instructed a legal opinion on challenging various parts of this Act, specifically the trafficking provisions and the children's provisions as they are implemented in Scotland. Because we are a legal organisation representing individuals, we need to wait for things to come into force and for individuals to be affected by this in order to bring human rights actions for them. But we're standing ready in order to try and combat bits of this act within all the powers that we can. And most excitedly, I would say, the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission have announced that they are bringing a really significant court action challenging almost all the elements of this act, alleging that they are a violation of Articles 2, 3, 4, and 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. So all of the provisions basically that I've summarised, the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission are challenging as a violation of the European Convention on Human Rights. And very interestingly, relatedly, they are bringing a challenge under the Windsor framework, which was the framework that was established in Northern Ireland after Brexit, alleging that the the UK government committed to not eroding human rights in Northern Ireland. And this act does just that. And therefore, it's a violation of the Windsor Framework. And if they're able to argue successfully that the act is a violation of the Windsor Framework, then it cannot apply in Northern Ireland, which is a real, really important element there. They issued judicial review proceedings. Permission was granted on the papers in that case, which means it went through the first SIFT stage, and it's going to have its substantive hearing in January 2024. That means that this act will face its first major legal test very, very soon about whether it can apply at all. And I, for one, am very, very hopeful about what can happen there. And I know that organisations up and down the country are helping them out. So it's good to finish on a positive note and think of things like this. One of my favourite quotes from Lula da Silva: those in powers can kill one, two or three roses, but they will never be able to stop the coming of spring. And I do think that if we stick together and keep at it, then the horrors of this act will, I hope, not come to pass.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at HRC Scotland. Thank you.